I declare open the public hearing of the House of Representatives Standing Committee on the Social Policy and Legal Affairs in Canberra for the inquiry into local adoption. As I have stated on numerous occasions, the committee acknowledges the profound effects of past forced adoption and removal policies and practices, which was also formally acknowledged by the House of Representatives in its resolution of the 3rd of December 2013. The committee understands that for many of those affected, adoption continues to be a deeply distressing issue. The focus of this present inquiry is not those past practices and policies. The terms of reference require the committee to consider how we might provide stability and permanency for children in out-of-home care and consider a nationally consistent framework to use when adoption is a viable option. Our inquiry is therefore intended to be forward-looking and solutions-focused. Since the first public hearing on the 22nd of May, a number of witnesses have appeared before the committee to provide evidence. The committee has heard from Commonwealth, state and territory government departments, non-government organisations, adoption and post-adoption support services, academics and other service providers. The committee appreciates the information and insights provided by all witnesses to date. Today we will hear from Adopt Change and the Institute of Adoption Studies. In accordance with the committee's resolution of the 20th of September 2016, audio from this hearing will be broadcast on the Parliament's website and the proof and official transcripts of proceedings will be published on the Parliament's website. Those present here today are advised that filming and recording are permitted during the hearing. I remind members of the media who may be present or listening online of the need to fairly and accurately report the proceedings of the committee. I now welcome the representative, Ms. Renee Carter, from Adopt Change to evidence today. However, for the Hansard record, would you please state your full name and the capacity in which you appear before the committee?
Renee Carter, CEO of Adopt Change.
Thank you. Although the committee does not require you to give evidence under oath, I should advise you that this hearing is a legal proceeding of the Parliament and therefore has the same standing as a proceeding of the House. The giving of false or misleading evidence is a serious matter and may be regarded as a contempt of Parliament. The evidence today will be recorded by Hansard and attracts parliamentary privilege. I now invite you to make an opening statement before we proceed to discussion.
Thank you for inviting Adopt Change to speak at today's hearing following our submission. Adoption is not a cure-all. The trauma, grief and loss a child in state care has typically experienced in their young lives cannot be wiped away by adoption. But adoption is a means that can provide a child with stability and legal security in a safe and nurturing family home, with the benefits of accessing the rights of a biological child within the family they have joined. It provides legal affirmation of a bond with a family who can provide therapeutic care and assist a child in the journey of healing. Adoption can provide the opportunity to experience better life outcomes, access inheritance rights, be free of the system, identify as a member of the family they have become a part of, have camp notes signed by the family they now live with, for decisions to be made within this family, to be able to travel interstate without permission, to be able to have photos in school newsletters, to no longer have monthly case manager visits and for a sense of normality. And in the case of children in out-of-home care, they often already have established family relationships with their foster families and want to have the certainty of their belonging confirmed. We're not talking about removing children from their families of origin. These are children who have already been removed due to abuse or neglect. These are children that in far too many cases have been in the system bouncing around it for a large portion of their childhood. Children can move 10 times, 30 times, 70 times. They are not returning home. Over 32,000 of them have been in the system for over 2 years, and too many of them end up in residential care, and some of them end up living in a hotel with a caseworker. Children deserve to be provided with nurture, safety, and true permanency, and instead they are being parented by the state, and the state is not capable of providing the love and stability that children must have. It should not be surprising that over a third of the children who exit the state care system at 18 are homeless in their first year after leaving. Adoption is not a suitable option for every child, but it should be an option when adoption is in their best interest. Surely this is for more than the 143 children adopted from the 50,000 children in state care last year. Complexity, delays and barriers to adoption for children who could exit the system have instead bound these children to state care and compounded the trauma that they have already experienced. We'll be picking up the pieces for years to come for the children who were exposed to bouncing around a system from which the negative mental, physical and social impacts are well known. We must simplify the system, including introducing national consistency, not to make adoptions faster or easier for adoptive parents, but to allow children access to permanency, not until they are 18, but for life. We must recognise children's rights and put them first. If they want to be adopted by the people they already call family, they need some agency over their own life. Adoption is a tool. It's not in itself inherently good or bad. It can be used well or terribly. And we have seen the detrimental impacts of when adoption has been inflicted on people unjustly. Closed, secret, forced adoptions. The ricochet effects are still felt today. There is an outcry to never see this occur again, and rightly so. We cannot allow this, but we also cannot allow children to suffer in limbo. So we need to ensure that adoption is implemented ethically and in the best interests of children. There are aspects of adoption that can be improved, including the introduction of an integrated birth certificate or adoption certificate that recognises and respects both families and a child's identity, families of origin and adoptive families. A child's history should not be erased from their birth certificate. We need to prioritise providing children with a better alternative to the limbo of statutory care. Children deserve to grow up with certainty within a family. It is imperative that Australia prioritise and invest heavily in supporting families to stay together or to reunify through the implementation of supports and evidence-based programs to avoid children ever needing to enter the state care system. But in the cases where children are unable to return home, their fleeting childhood should be respected and their interests put first. They deserve what every child deserves: family, belonging, stability, safety, nurture, and for their voice to be heard.
Thank you, Ms. Carter. Thank you for your submission. So I'll start with a few questions, and indeed the same theme has come through with your submission as some of our many of our past submissions, and indeed at the hearings on Friday. You refer to children bouncing around the system, and there's a need for simplification of the system, which is in the best interest of the child. And indeed, one of the barriers that is a clear emerging issue is the inconsistency across the states and territories in Australia, and also the sheer amount of bureaucracy that's involved, which means parents give up.
Yes.
Or prospective adoptive parents give up with the system, and indeed, of course, the child is left in that in out of home care. Could you expand upon the bureaucracy element a little bit more, and where you would rank that in terms of one of the barriers to adoption?
Yes, so we did some research last year around the barriers that people were experiencing. So if you look at the cohort of prospective adoptive parents that are already foster parents, they may have children in their care for a decade and not be able to adopt them because of red tape. So that will come down to what state you live in, what the legislation is, what the policies are, what the processes are, which agency you're dealing with, which caseworker you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. So the delays that were experienced are everything from caseworker changing over, paperwork being lost, having to start again, having to resubmit, or legislation not allowing or not making provision for adoption. So it really is very complex, and those prospective adoptive parents can try for years to adopt the children in their care, including having the children actually voicing their opinion about wanting to be adopted. Mm. Then you have prospective adoptive parents who don't have a child in their care that would very readily do so. Some have been prospective adoptive parents for many years and face a whole range of barriers, and that can be based on criteria of what type of parent, or just again the same kind of barriers around being able to place a child for adoption.
And can I say, can I ask, are the barriers inconsistent around the states in terms of for prospective adoptive parents?
Yes and no. So yes, with what some of those details are, but mm-hmm. it all came back to just being incredibly complex, really mm-hmm. hard to navigate the system, to know where to get information, mm-hmm. and facing a range of barriers. So quite similar in some ways,
mm-hmm.
but with the exception of New South Wales, I guess, which has changed more recently.
Okay. And what do you think is one of the key differentiations between New South Wales and other states that sort of negates those barriers somewhat?
Yes, look, there's been work on legislation and making it, I guess, more accessible for children to be adopted through out-of-home care.
Mm-hmm.
So, and one of those things is the legislation around dispensation of consent when it's in the best interest of the child.
Mm-hmm.
There is also, I guess, an appetite within New South Wales, within government and department, to provide adoption as an option for children that have been in state care.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an overall view that permanency should be reviewed within a set time frame to see if a child can be restored home, and when not, to look at what permanency options there are rather than a long-term order of a child being in state care till 18.
Okay, and one more question and one request, and then I'll pass to my deputy chair. So what sort of benefits, in your view, does adoption offer that makes it a better alternative than permanent care orders?
Mm. Permanent care orders are till 18, and can be in some cases, I guess, contested, don't necessarily apply across state borders. So if you want to move, for example,
mm-hmm.
And it doesn't provide that lifelong sense of belonging and having legally joined a family.
Mm.
So there are a number of, I guess, issues with that.
Mm-hmm.
There's reasons that permanent care orders are sometimes preferred,
mm-hmm.
And that's because some issues around, I guess, the legalities of severing ties with adoption.
Mm.
And that's where we really need to review and make sure that we're implementing ethical open adoption and improving that.
Mm. Indeed, for the benefit of the other committee members, with the exception of Dr. Freelander, who was there on Friday, we had a very interesting anecdote that was shared by Mr. Inch in relation to a permanent care order where these foster parents had had a care order for a child for 12 years, and then that child, the parents went interstate, and the child had new foster parents, and both sets of parents of foster carers wanted the child reunited, as does the child, and this child is still separated. So thank you for elucidating on that. You mentioned the research in relation to barriers to adoption. Could I ask if you could send that to the committee, take that on notice in the outcome of that research,
mm-hmm.
so for the benefit of the committee, and pass to Ms. Clayton.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Ms. Carter, for your evidence this afternoon. Do I take it that you're an advocate for the New South Wales reforms?
Yes.
And what is it that you are attracted to in those reforms?
There's heavy investment in early intervention and family preservation first as a priority, and then a recognition that if that can't work, that other permanent care options are explored, so whether that is guardianship with family or adoption.
So we saw a doubling of the numbers for adoption. Was there an equal... I mean, this is perhaps an unfair question to you and it should go to New South Wales, I suppose, but was there equally a spike in restoration of families? Given
I know that there was a figure quoted recently, I think it was about 24% decline of children coming into state care through out-of-home care last year.
Anyway, we can follow that up, but if it didn't come out in the evidence on Friday, I'd just be interested to know that. So.
Yes.
So you've done some research around these the barriers to adoption, and obviously it's primarily a state issue. We've got different jurisdictions with different, different regulations and around. But it is also true that there is some research around that would suggest that adoption is not always the better answer for out-of-home care children. So I'm just wondering if you could give us a sense of where you think it is appropriate And where are the lines that you draw for inappropriate use of adoption in out-of-home care situations?
So I think it's hard to draw an exact line, but some of the, I guess, factors would be that when a child is old enough to voice their opinion, and legislation covers that as well. So, for example, in New South Wales, over 12 able to consent to their own adoption. When a family has been living together for many years, the foster family want to adopt, the child wants to be adopted, there isn't necessarily a contesting of the adoption as well, that it seems that then the state should be supporting those situations. One of the things that we're doing additional research into at the moment is simple adoption, which is another form of adoption that doesn't sever legal ties with birth family. And I think we potentially need to introduce another form of adoption to cover some of the situations where that would be more suitable.
That's what I was going to ask you, is like, what do you... I mean, there are serious misgivings for lots of people around adoption. Mm. So what is it that makes your sense of adoption so different to what has been experienced in the past?
So we're not talking about closed adoptions and adoptions where children are being removed for terrible reasons, you know, and it shouldn't be an adoption pipeline. It's not about adoptive parents. It should always be a service for children. So the difference needs to be that it is open, so there are relationships that are maintained, and there are case studies that are happening right now where you have families that have good contact, and the family of origin and the adoptive family retain contact, and the child is growing up within two families, in a sense. They've got that there. So it really is just a legal, another legal protection for the child. And really, in us advocating for adoption, we're not saying that the way that we have it set up currently is perfect. So, for example, the birth certificates are one issue that we hear from both sides of the fence, that that is actually really a key issue, that when a child is adopted, their birth certificate changes, their history is wiped off their birth certificate, and everybody knows that that child wasn't born to the new family. Often they're, I think, 80-something percent of children adopted in Australia are over age 5. So the children are being encouraged to understand their history and know about their history, retain relationships with their family, and yet we have a hangover from the past with a birth certificate. So there are things that we need to improve. Our adoption form now isn't perfect, but it is definitely a far cry from being in a state system where you bounce around and you don't have that sense of permanency. And we have people that, I guess, are within our community that reached 18 and voted for themselves to be adopted, in the sense that that was the first thing they wanted to do at age 18, and they grew up in foster care. So we're hearing from young people that that was really important to them. That's markedly different to people that had something inflicted on them and done in a very unfair, secretive way.
So we've got some changes around the birth certificate, which, agreed, everybody has said is an important issue, and some... you've said a preference to move to something called open adoption, which would enable maintenance of relationships with families of origin.
So we
am
have,
I missing anything else? Yeah, I'm so just trying to understand, given the acceptance that past practices have been appalling, what is shifting now to make you much more comfortable with this as a use of... providing permanency for kids in out-of-home care.
Yes, it is very much more transparent and the openness with retaining the connections with family, so that really what it is about now for adoption is not about, you know, pretending that you've brought in a child into your family and they're your biological child. It is about offering permanency and legal security to a child that is often already living with you and has been for a long time. And so that they are able to have that sense of security, that there isn't going to be a state care worker come in and move them, which has happened previously. So they actually have that sense of belonging. So I think that's quite a different situation to forced adoptions, where often people didn't find out till they were maybe 50 years old that that's what had happened to them, that actually it is really important to have that woven through their upbringing that you were adopted, this is what it's about, and often they've had a say in that as well.
Thank you.
Something you just touched on then was, which has come up a couple of times, is what do we understand adoption to be? Can you sort of discuss what you think the changes have been in adoption and how adoption from previous generations is different to what you're talking about now?
Look, really it's a legal mechanism that provides for a child to be a legal part of the new adoptive family. So they then receive inheritance rights from that family if something happens to them or if something happens to the family. It's as though they were part of the biological family, so they, you know, they would then be placed with another family member if something happened to the parents. They're not put back into the system. Decisions around even if the child dies, I guess if you're part of the state care system, then those adoptive parents or the foster parents wouldn't have a say in that per se. So it's really around legal permanency for that family and legal security. There are ways of enhancing that or improving that, but at the moment that is the most secure legal option for that child, to know that that's the permanent placement for them. And in the same way for foster carers, they don't have any real legal security, and children can be moved even after 10 years because of a change of agency worker or policy or...
And moving to state, like I mentioned.
Different decisions. So there really isn't any legal security there, so that is the most secure option.
So, you know, one of the sort of famous stories that Steve Jobs told was that his adoptive mother refused to love him for the first year because she didn't know whether she'd be allowed to keep him or not. Mm. I mean, do we have any sort of understanding about what sort of impact the lack of permanency has on children?
There's a lot of, I guess, research around the negative impacts of impermanency. So I guess coming out of, you know, out of home care, so the homelessness, mental health, lower education, high rates of early pregnancy. There's a lot, and that impermanency is on top of children in out-of-home care have typically experienced abuse and or neglect, and they have often complex trauma, so then we're bouncing them around. That lack of stability is very damaged, so there's statistics around if a child has been moved six times, they're, I think it's 3.8 times more likely to have a breakdown with their next placement. So we're seeing something that is perpetuating impermanency. And it makes sense. I mean, why would a child then trust that they're going to be somewhere permanently and then they can act out, they can push for that breakdown because they don't trust that it's going to be a placement that works, and they want to be the first one to get in there. So there's a whole range of trust issues, and you know, that child really needs to know that they're in a secure placement and that they, you know, have that opportunity to really start to heal.
Thank you,
Mary. Okay. Ms. Hassan?
Thank you for your evidence. I think that you framed your opening statement in a really way of balancing, I guess, the two problems that we're vexed with, is the past and what's going to happen in the future. I have just a couple of questions. You talked in your opening statement about the restoration to birth families and that should be timely. Is there any evidence or studies to suggest that there is a benchmark where we should say, okay, 2 years, you're kicked out of the state system and you need to be adopted, or is there a time frame that we should consider to offer the restoration to the birth family? And the second thing as part of that, are there gaps in services, I assume there are, prior to removal of these kids that are coming into out-of-home care? Is there not more things that could be happening before the kids are taken, or even in that window period between being removed and then seeking that restoration?
So in terms of timeframes, a couple of them that are mentioned are 2 years, so working towards a two-year decision for a child.
Where does that derive from?
I can't answer that, actually.
Okay.
Yep. But one of the things, I guess, that goes further than that is that with very young children, and I think Bernardo's in particular speaks to it as well, is that actually the time frame should be shorter because of the damage, I guess, that can be avoided. Mm-hmm. So I know there's some research around the first 3 years of a child's life and the importance of that time. And so I guess the sooner the decision is made, the decision really needs to come down to how much early childhood adversity can you avoid for that child for better outcomes. It has to be child-centred timing. And that's, you know, even 2 years, if you look at that, that's actually still a big portion of a child's life. Mm-hmm. And so that's where it's important that when you talk about the gaps in services, that the services are evidence-based and that when it's not working, there's more confidence around, well, this isn't working, we can't keep sending a child home and having them further damaged by what's occurring.
Yep. And just my last question is... the lack of support from the relevant adoption agencies. So who's providing adoptive or adoption services now? My understanding is that it's being done.
It's varied. So, you know, whether that's from the state departments, yep, and then in some of the states there's also, I guess, commissioned agencies, non-government organisations that are involved. So, for example, in New South Wales, there's 47 foster care agencies. 3 of them are accredited adoption agencies as well, and there's a move to have more accreditation.
And with your research, and would you think that accredited agencies rather than government are a better place to deliver that? Or
look, it's tricky because there needs to be a really strong governance structure where there's consistency, and part of the problem is with the complexity and the lack of consistency. So there does need to be a very strong framework regardless of who's delivering that, and then you have within, whether it's department or an agency, differing views on adoption, for example. Mm-hmm. So then you'll have inconsistent delivery of those services as well.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Christensen.
Oh, look, I'm sorry that I wasn't here for the majority of your presentation, but I had a look at your submission. Thank you very much for that. I just want to ask 2 questions, really. One is, you've mentioned here in your in your submission where you talked about the barriers to adoption, national research that was conducted by your organisation, and you talk about, you know, the... experience of prospective adoptive parents, and one of the statements that's made here is that some of those who already had permanent care or guardianship orders spoke of how those orders did not provide the child with the belonging that they needed. And I read the statement that was underneath and I understood that, but I'm just wondering, we've heard from other people who have appeared before us that there is a similarity or a convergence between these terms, permanent care and guardianship, and open adoption. Legally, from what you're saying, what is the practical difference or legal difference between the two terms? Is there any?
Yes.
So yes. What exactly would be the legal difference?
The legal difference... Sorry. Is really around, I guess, contestability and if it's transferable between states. And it's very limited legal rights, I guess, of that family if it's until 18.
It's not really permanent.
It's not really permanent. It's until 18, and it's a form of legal order. And, it does go part way to providing a level of stability. And in some cases, a permanent care order or guardianship order is probably more appropriate. So not all situations are, it's not one size fits all for adoption. It just needs to be one of the options on the table that is available to those families where it's appropriate.
I guess the one thing that, the only other question I had is the one thing that's, I don't know if the word shock is right, but it has sort of a bit shocked me, is the level of anger I think that we're seeing from some of the submitters against the concept of adoption, full stop. Mm. And I guess that's based on past experiences of it. But, you know, for those, and we are getting a fair few of people that are actually saying, do not go down this track, do not even talk about adoption, don't bring it back, you know. to any great degree. What would be your response to the people that just have this view that we shouldn't do adoption because of past mistakes, because actually, I just want to add one thing. There's almost the implication that adoption in and of itself, even including open adoption or simple adoption, is not in the child's best interest, and in fact that it's completely in the interests of those people who want to adopt. I don't concur with that, but I'm wanting to hear your feedback.
I think
to
a
that.
Big part of that, there's obviously a huge amount of hurt, and rightly so, and you can see that the damage that can be done when it's done incorrectly. But one of the key things is around that they weren't valued as people that had their own rights and for their voice to be heard, etc. I think a similar thing is happening for children who are in out-of-home care in a different scenario. They are not being listened to, and instead they're being shunted around a system and having very detrimental impacts. So there's going to be a similar cohort of people that have come from a different, I guess, you know, there's had something different inflicted on them, which is being bounced around a system that we know from evidence is very damaging. So we might be avoiding adoption, but to avoid that at all costs when it can actually provide some very good outcomes for people, I think is the wrong approach. What we need to learn from the past is that it's a tool. How do we make it a more appropriate tool that works for more people? Because it really is just around providing legal security and a sense of belonging for the child and the family.
Thank you. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Freelander?
I think Sharon had a couple of questions.
Yeah, I just want to cover back off on something, if that's okay. But and it really follows on from George's line of questioning there, I think. And one of the criticisms that we have heard very loud and clear around adoption is that once the child is adopted, there are essentially no longer monitored by the state. There aren't any checks and balances, so their welfare is not being monitored. Is it your view that there should be some role for government or agencies after adoption has taken place?
Only in the sense that you would have a government role in a normal family. So, you know, children are involved in school and other life situations where there will be, I guess, the same kind of opportunities to monitor how a child is going. A big part of children coming through out-of-home care and wanting that permanency and that normality is around not wanting to be monitored and not wanting to be checked on regularly. So really there needs to be a really rigorous process to make sure that this family situation that a child is going into is appropriate, so that then they can be working as a normal family unit.
I guess my other question would be, when I look at the figures, I mean, there's a conflation between out-of-home care and adoption constantly in this inquiry, okay? There are almost 48,000 kids in out-of-home care, but nearly half of them are in kinship care arrangements. So if I were to look at the figures of adoption that are a part of your submission, saying 204 were adopted in 2016 and 17, that is 0.4% of the out-of-home care population. But clearly that is certainly where most, when I look at the New South Wales figures, 86% of children adopted from the 152 came out of home care. So I guess my view, what I would put to you is clearly the vast, vast majority of kids in out-of-home care are not going to be adopted, according to, you know, all of the patterns that we see at this point. So would it not be, I mean, what would your view be of how to better support all of those that are never going to be adopted?
They still need a great deal of stability, and there still is a place for, I guess, what we'd term permanent care orders that give them that stability till 18 or give them more stability. So it's not one solution. There needs to be basically the concept or the understanding of permanency, whether a child can be return home, whether a child can be with a relative through kinship care and actually giving them the right support. So we're often hearing about how they're not well-supported families that are looking after relatives. And then I think we will see an increase in adoptions. Not, I mean, even in New South Wales, they're projecting, I think it's 250 a year. It's still a very small portion of children. But if we're seeing less come into the system, more able to go home, more able to be in guardianship with kin, and then those that, where it suits, to go into adoption, the thing that we want to avoid is having a child on a long-term foster care order that actually just means that they will bounce through the system. That's the thing that needs to be avoided when it's around the child. If I can backtrack on the question you asked me before as well about monitoring, whilst I don't think there needs to be the monitoring, there definitely needs to be access to post-adoptive supports, which is something that we don't have enough of in Australia. And that is that when the child needs it, at whichever point issues come up from their trauma, which they will have, that they are able to access supports. So it may not be, you may adopt a child at age 5 and they're fine until they hit 16, and then you need to be able to access supports, and they're limited. So really making sure that that's something that we're prioritising, and I guess that's something that I've heard about, I guess, past practices as well. We need to make sure we cater to adult adoptees. So making sure that there is a suite of supports there.
Thank you. I mean, I'd certainly be looking at, you know, how we actually better support these families before getting into the crisis where they end up in out-of-home care and, you know, down this pathway. But thanks for your evidence today.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much for your evidence today, Ms Carter. I just wanted to ask you a couple of things about your own background and where you are coming from and what jurisdictions you work in. Can you tell us a little bit?
Adopt Change is national, so within Australia. So we have been, I guess, reviewing the approach to adoption from a national perspective, and really looking at making sure, advocating for children to have access to safety, nurture and permanency. So, and acknowledging that adoption is not always the best way to have that.
Right, but what's your background? What's your training?
From a business and communications background.
And does your service deal with children in out-of-home care, or you're purely an advocacy group?
We've got the advocacy background. We support a lot of families, and we've actually just been commissioned to, within New South Wales, to recruit, support and train foster carers and guardians and adoptive parents. So we're working to, I guess, make sure that we have more carers that are able to work with children long term.
Right, and your funding comes from?
That particular aspect is New South Wales Government.
Okay. And I just want to go back to your opening statement when you said that the New South Wales Government is investing more in early intervention services. Mm. Now, I take issue with that because I don't see any evidence for that on the ground. Mm. And you're aware of the TUNE report recently?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What did you think of that report?
So, I think there's things that are being implemented at the moment based on that report. There's an acknowledgement that it's not working to have an ever-increasing number of children coming into state care, and that I guess it's, you know, under... there's a question around how much it's helped to have non-government organisations be delegated with authority. And I think, you know, that is something that is going to be reviewed. I think the move towards more outcomes measures in New South Wales is a good thing to actually measure how things are performing. So I guess, you know, the jury's still out in some ways. But there does seem to be, from my understanding, and it's not to say that New South Wales is the only one either that's investing in early intervention, but a desire to put in place evidence-based programs now so that they can be tracked and look at what the outcomes are.
Yeah. And look, we've received quite a lot of evidence about early adoption, and I have major concerns about that, but do you have any views on what is the window that we should be looking at where a decision is made about permanency of care?
My view is that there are a lot of children already in state care that are older and that have been in for years, that are regularly voicing their opinion, as are their families, that they want to be able to access adoption. I actually think they should be prioritised because they have are already formed family units.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, often that might be that the family of origin and community support that as well. But for whatever reason, there is red tape in the way, and I think they are the ones that should be the priority.
Right.
I mean, I guess, you know, it's... And when you asked about my experience as well, I've also provided some crisis care personally. When you see a child that doesn't know where they're going next, that their option is to stay in a hotel with a caseworker, when you see what impact that has on a child... Mm-hmm. I guess that's where, you know, my personal view is, that's really not okay. We have to do so much better than that.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily an issue of adoption. That's an issue of appropriate care placements, surely.
Yes, although I think we're limiting the appropriate care placements when there are less carers happy to put their hand up knowing that that placement could be changed. So there's people that don't invest their... themselves knowing that foster care isn't necessarily permanent. So some people can't bear the thought that, you know, after 5 years a child might be moved on. And it does happen.
Sure.
And Dr. Freeland, if we're running short of time, so one more question. Ms. Husser's got another question. And then we've got another witness waiting.
Okay. And are you suggesting that this program that you want to see implemented is for all children? Does it include Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children or...?
I think all children need to be the focus, and I guess when you look at Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, you need to put the placement principle in place because of past practices and the impact that it's still having today, and working very closely with community to make those decisions.
Right. Can I very quickly ask a short question?
If we can put that on notice, unless it's got a short answer.
How many of the children that are adopted now have disabilities? Could you answer that?
I think it's actually quite high, but I can't give you the statistics.
Could we put that on notice?
Yes.
Okay, Ms. Hudson. Yeah.
No question. Just very briefly, and I'd be happy for you to take this on notice. Mm-hmm. We had the question before about monitoring post-adoption, and I, you know, hear your answer. In kinship care, is there any monitoring once those children go into kinship care? Because we do know that half of those kids are in... care with families, so if you can come back to us on that.
Yep, sure.
Thank you. Just in the interest of time.
Thanks, Ms. Husser. And in relation to kinship care, following on from that, would you agree, and perhaps you can take this on notice as well, or you may be able to answer, that we shouldn't assume that kinship care, notwithstanding the number of children in kinship care, that that should be the done deal as well, because you know that's therefore the right permanency option, that certainly children who are in kinship care should also be considered for adoption, particularly when the child's safety may still be compromised.
It has to go through the same, I guess, rigorous checks to make sure that situation is in the best interest of the child.
Yeah.
And really where permanency comes in, if that is through something like guardianship, which doesn't change the legal relationship of their family. They're already part of that family.
Yeah.
So they don't need the same, I guess, legal order.
Sure. And just to sort of wrap up, would you agree, and thank you so much for your very compelling submission, would you agree that legal permanency and legal... On Friday we heard about one of the submitters saying that adoption provides children with a profound sense of place. Mm-hmm. In terms of permanency, would you agree that legal permanency and legal security in turn enhances that profound sense of place for the child, but also obviously has an impact on the parent from your experience?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, well, Ms. Carter, look, thank you very much for your submission here today. Oh, and one other further thing, you did mention in response to Mr. Falinski that there has been a lot of evidence on the impact impermanency has on children in terms of homelessness, drug addiction, etc.
Yes.
Is there a summary of research that you could provide to this committee in relation to that evidence?
I can provide you some of those, yes.
Thank you very much. So
I'd just like to thank you for your attendance here today, and I'd like to thank my fellow committee members for their questions and your answers. If you've been asked to provide any additional information, would you please forward it to the Secretariat by the 16th of July 2018, and you'll be sent a copy of the transcript of your evidence, and we'll have an opportunity to request any corrections to transcription errors. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I now welcome the representatives from the Institute of Open Adoption Studies to give evidence today. For the Hansard record, would you each please state your full names and the capacity in which you appear before the committee?
Associate Professor Amy Conley-Wright, Director of the Institute of Open Adoption Studies.
Thank you.
Professor Judy Cashmore, Professor of Sociolegal Research and Policy at the University of Sydney, and also part of the Professorial Fellow at the Open Adoption Institute.
Thank you. Although the committee does not require you to give evidence under oath, I should advise you that this hearing is a legal proceeding of the Parliament and therefore has the same standing as the proceeding of the House. The giving of false or misleading evidence is a serious matter and may be regarded as a contempt of Parliament. The evidence given today will be recorded by Hansard and attracts parliamentary privilege. I now invite you to make a brief opening statement before we proceed to discussion.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak to the inquiry on local adoption, my colleague Professor Judy Cashmore and I. The Institute of Open Adoption Studies was established in 2016 to undertake applied research about the best interests of children in the context of open adoption from out-of-home care as practiced in New South Wales. Through the Institute's extensive engagement with a wide range of stakeholders, we are aware that there are strong views about adoption and that many will disagree that adoption can never be in a child's best interests, given the legacy of the past. We acknowledge that adoption is not appropriate for all children, particularly for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. Care from kin and community is preferred, and adoption is generally not considered culturally appropriate. However, there are still many children in care for whom open adoption may be appropriate, and only a small number of adoptions occurring. While we may not agree on adoption, we can all agree on the fundamental importance of the best interests of the child. For a child, that means being with a family where they feel safe, secure, and loved. Our research is capturing the voices of children and what has mattered to them about their relationships with important people in their lives. From this research, a review of the literature, and an analysis of state and territory policy, we have recommended several principles to promote children's best interests in adoption from care, and we'd like to highlight a few. Firstly, adoption is a service to the child, not to parents. Adoption is about providing a sense of permanency and emotional security for children, not providing children for parents. Children's need for emotional security, belonging, and identity must be paramount when making decisions about their future. If the child has been in a stable and secure long-term relationship with his or her carers, this must outweigh the rights and wishes of the birth parents. Secondly, it is important to sustain the connection between children and their birth families. There is strong evidence to suggest that for most adopted persons, knowing their background helps them make sense of and come to terms with their adoptive status and achieve a healthy and positive identity. Even if they do not consent to the adoption, birth parents should have the opportunity to participate in the development of an adoption plan and to be supported to maintain contact with their child. For open adoptions to be effective, all parties to an adoption should be able to access support before, during, and after an adoption. Thirdly, children should have their views considered and taken into account and opportunities to participate in the decisions that affect them. Research has found that adults consistently underestimate children's capacities. Allowing children with sufficient maturity and competence to provide sole consent to their own adoption provides children with a voice about who they consider their family to be. Finally, we need better evidence to inform policy and practice around open adoption and other permanency pathways in the Australian context. Through our research and sector consultations, the dearth of adoption literature relevant to the Australian context and contemporary practice has become apparent. The Australian government is in the position to facilitate whole-of-government agreements that would allow for tracking of children's outcomes across safety, health, welfare, and education domains with appropriate safeguards for privacy concerns. It will be critical to invest in research that follows children's experiences over time and their long-term outcomes. We need longitudinal data to understand the outcomes for children in care and the efficacy of policies and systems to support them.
Thank you very much, Professor Wright. First of all, you mentioned that adoption is should be a service for a child and not a parent. And we've heard about the inconsistency of approach across states and territories and the resultant bureaucracies and red tape that complicates and makes adoption a very complicated issue and indeed permanency, that sense of permanency, a very complicated issue from the most practical things in relation to travel, for example, interstate for a child. We've heard about the importance that the approach to adoption should be consistent across state and territories. Could you elucidate some of the inconsistencies, the sort of blaring inconsistencies, if you like, across states and territories that are really impacting this red tape concern?
Well, in terms of one area of inconsistency is when adoption will be considered for children in out-of-home care. So particularly to highlight the New South Wales example, there is a very clear process to follow when adoption would be considered, whereas in other states and territories, it's less clear when adoption would be considered for children in out-of-home care. Mm-hmm. Another space that we'd like to highlight is around children's consent. So that's it is inconsistent in terms of whether children are offered the opportunity to consent for their own adoption. And in New South Wales, it's the only jurisdiction where children who are age 12 and older, if they have sufficient capacity, can provide sole consent to their own adoption. And therefore, the consent of the birth parents is not needed.
Yeah. So that's the sort of goes to the voice of the child and timeliness of the decision-making, which seems to make the New South Wales reforms, making the New South Wales system a better working adoption system. In previous hearings, we've heard about as adults, we tend to think in adult timeframes versus a child's timeframe. And you mentioned that we underestimate children's capacities and their what they feel about their situation. So how do you think we can build those two elements in relation to the voice of the child and that timeliness in decision-making in a national framework?
So I think giving children an opportunity to give voice to their experiences of family. So some of the research that the Institute of Open Adoption Studies has done is asking children about their experiences of family and the impact of adoption. And many of them have spontaneously talked about the importance of belonging, the people who care for them, that gives them the sense of family over the connection of blood ties. So offering an opportunity for children to have the opportunity to understand adoption and to give input into adoption as is the practice in New South Wales. In terms of timeliness, it's about respecting that when the longer children remain in care, the more likely they are to experience placement moves. So permanency decisions that are happening within a more timely period of time will minimize the likelihood of placement moves for children and give children that sense of security to stay with the family that who have been caring for them.
Yep. And are we already seeing positive results in New South Wales in terms of the timeframes they're putting on this?
Well, we are seeing increases in the numbers of adoptions, and there have been decreases in the amount of time that adoptions are taking. Okay. In some cases, the amount of time is coming down to about 12 months in some cases.
Good. Thank you. Dr. Freeland?
I do have some concerns about those timeframes. In terms of the birth families. Do you have any concerns about that?
Well, I would comment that it's more than timeliness, it's important to do adoptions right, which is a theme, again, of the inquiry. And the process in New South Wales holds a very high standard for casework because adoptions are processed by the Supreme Court. So even though there have been efficiencies that have been made to reduce the bureaucracy in the system, it's not about doing that at the cost of anyone's rights, that the rights of birth parents. Birth parents still need to be consulted. And in New South Wales, they're consulted about an adoption plan and about contact with children. And it's important to maintain those safeguards so that birth parents have the opportunity to maintain those relationships with their children.
And what numbers of adoptions are already happening in New South Wales are opposed adoptions by the birth family?
I don't have that information on hand. I'd have to take that on notice.
Could you?
Yeah, but we are doing a study. I'll comment that we are looking at a case file review of all the adoptions that were completed in 2017, and the data collection is currently being conducted. So we'll have a sense of what happens in contested matters, what the conditions are, as well as the numbers of contested adoptions.
Yeah. And do you know how many of these children that are being adopted have disabilities?
So I understand from some previous research that that has not been systematically tracked, and so I understand the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare Studies was going to provide that information to the inquiry. We can also...
Okay. And do you think there is a need for post-adoption support for these families?
Indeed, that is something that we have heard very clearly from prospective adoptive parents. So we've done some research with current foster carers in New South Wales. We did focus groups with 30 foster carers, and I held an online survey with an additional 76 foster carers. And the need for post-adoption support was one of the primary issues that was raised in that study, that foster carers identified that given children's early adverse experiences, they're very likely to need some access to therapeutic supports, and that the concerns about adoption are that they would no longer necessarily have the access to the kinds of specialist services that children need. So we absolutely do think that there's a need for developing the service system around post-adoption supports here in Australia.
And do you have any breakdown of the reasons for these children not being able to be cared for by their families?
There may be some information on that from the Pathways of Care study. My colleague, Professor Cashmore, would like to comment.
Look, we, in terms of the children who are being adopted, we will have that information when we've got the... It's something like 100 children or 100 cases that are currently the adoption matters. I'd just like to go back to your comment too in relation to how many of them are opposed. Where there's a judgment that's a reported judgment, and there's a judge in New South Wales who does a large number of them. So we know that it's a minority, but we also know that they can dispense with consent, and that the issue for some birth parents is they don't want to be seen as being in the position as having relinquished their children. So that, in fact, there, you know, there are a lot of sensitivities and long-term concerns that need to be taken account.
Families, in my experience, have either intellectual disability, mental illness, whole range of factors. I have major concerns about it. I don't mind declaring my concerns. I just want to ask one last question, and I don't want to take up too much of your time. What evidence is there that the New South Wales government is investing more in early intervention?
Well, we've just got the budget out last Friday. Look, I'd like to...
That is the sort of question, sorry, Professor Cashmore,
you could take that on notice.
Yes, we can take that on notice. But I'd like to take it one step further too, that it's not just about what money is invested, it's also, is that money being invested in the right programs? And how do we know that? And I think that's a real concern. And I think that we need to be very clear about the sort of programs that are being bought from overseas and used in this way, and know that they are really the right programs for the right children. And also taking on board that, in fact, having a child in care costs quite a lot of money, and that amount of money, if it was invested before they went into care, might stop a lot of them entering care.
But hang on, we heard evidence that that is what's happening.
Sorry. There is an investment approach in New South Wales.
Yeah, and there are fewer people going into out-of-home care.
That are seeking to reinvest.
So, Mr. Polinski, do you have any questions? Mr. Christensen, and then Ms. Hussa.
Yeah, look, my question is to do with the Aboriginal and Islander cohort, and I asked this of another witness, and that is, why? I appreciate there's historical issues, but there's historical issues with adoption overall. Why, if we focus on the best interests of the child, and I'm actually going to get to another question on what that means, but when we focused on the best interests of the child, do we put cultural matters then above and beyond those best interests of the child?
Is there a problem with that?
It necessarily does that. I think it's in terms of really understanding what kinship means within the cultural context. And it's a very different understanding of who's connected to who in what way. And I'm not sure that necessarily the Aboriginal placement principle is working exactly as intended. But that's partly because the Aboriginal grandmothers in particular are taking on a lot of burden. And so we don't have enough Aboriginal carers. So we've got about a third of the children, from what I understand, who are in care with a Aboriginal close family member. Then the next step in the hierarchy is whether it's somebody within their family kinship group, within their kinship community group. And that's again about a third. And then you get to those who are not related in that sense but may have an Aboriginal connection. And it's after that that you've got children who are in care of non-Aboriginal carers. So I think I wouldn't want it to be seen. I think the big issue here, and Australia has a very sorry history, I think, in terms of not really listening to what the Aboriginal community has been saying loud and clear for a very long time, and that's that they want to have some self-determination and control over what happens to their children in the same way that Marcia Zug has talked about what happens to Indian native children in the US.
But wouldn't you agree that safety is paramount over cultural considerations?
It is.
The safety of the child. To Mr. Christensen's point, we're talking about the best interest of the child. Yes. And surely, and this is the UK experience, where historically they were putting cultural considerations above everything about cultures that they didn't necessarily, that an Anglo-Saxon culture didn't necessarily understand about an Indian culture, for example. And it was only until they changed their system to an open adoption system where they said, once it's determined that the safety of the child is compromised or it is not safe for that child to go back home, cultural consideration should take a second tier under the safety of the child should be paramount.
Of course, paramount. I think we're not disagreeing with that.
We're talking about adoption
as a legal order and taking into account the voices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in terms of their preferences.
With adoption. Respect, that's not what's been communicated. So with respect, what's been communicated is cultural issues should be put forward before the welfare of children, just because they happen to be coming from Indigenous
children. So you're clarifying that.
We're saying that they are both really important, and we're not saying that...
Wouldn't you say safety is the priority?
Safety. Yeah, I don't think it is as black and white as that.
So you would say that both considerations are equal and should be given equal weight.
Children's safety should always be paramount, and that's in terms of the child protection system, it always is paramount. But we're talking about, talking about the form of legal permanency and in terms of whether adoption is considered to be culturally appropriate. And that's where we're suggesting that community consultation should be involved in those decisions.
You have to let them answer. You can't just keep
speaking. I didn't expect to throw the grenade out of the table, but sorry for that.
I think you guys both need to go and read a book before you continue your questioning. This is quite dangerous.
No. Look.
Sorry, through the chair, Mr. Christensen.
I do have one other question.
Which books does Ms. Hussey suggest we read?
Do you have one more question?
It's just an understanding from the Institute what is defined by best interests of the child in the instance of adoption. I'd really like to understand from your Institute, which has obviously done a lot of work in this space, what you would define then as the best interest of the child. I think it's
and
very
if you could take that crucial on notice and some, because there has been some lack of clarity or understanding in terms of what was said today. So if you could take that on notice, and I'll pass to Ms. Hussar to ask questions.
Thank you both for your evidence today. I have a bit confused, I guess, at the state we're in. So we've got New South Wales making changes to the reforms that are currently happening, with no actually wholesale changes to some of the issues that we know about. So you raised the issue of parents having to relinquish care and the trauma that puts through a parent. That doesn't seem to be highlighted or anybody doing any work there.
No.
The birth certificates, my understanding is that they are still continuing to be changed to adoptive, to whitewash that kid's history, birth history. And there are still not adequate supports post-adoption. So they've made these changes to the numbers so that they can come out with, oh, look what we've done, but actually haven't changed any of those problems that everybody around this table and everyone that's given evidence thus far has all acknowledged is a problem. So to me, we've absolutely, well, they have put the horse well before the cart and haven't actually fine-tuned the issues that existed for those people in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s through various machinations of forced removal and forced adoptions. So I'm happy if you want to take it on notice and come back, but I'm also happy to understand more about where you're up to in terms of the advocacy and the support for the New South Wales changes when those things that we've all agreed to are need to be changed haven't actually changed.
So I think there is work underway to develop, certainly understanding the needs of birth families. We're doing research on the perspectives of birth parents in terms of their contact experiences with children and how they can be supported to have positive relationships with children and to build the practice in that space so that children can maintain ongoing relationships with their birth families. Including siblings and other important people in their lives. So we have current research underway in that space. New South Wales is also looking at trialling some post-permanency supports, particularly in the guardianship space. So I think this is an area of development, and New South Wales has recognised the need for practice development and research in the space through its investment, for example, in the Institute of Open Adoption Studies.
So I just want to go back, though. So they've allowed, they've changed things to make it easier for people to adopt children, but actually haven't changed some of those issues. So we're both in agreement that that's actually occurred, and they seem to be doing the work after.
Well, I would say that they have clarified the process for adoption and removed some of the barriers around adoption and are looking at the needs in terms of post-adoption support, the needs of birth families, and I know there's discussion in terms of the birth certificates as well.
Does that seem like it's been done a little bit back to front?
I'd agree that the issue about birth certificates is a legal fiction, and it's not true to what children's history is, and it doesn't help anyone. I think that's one of the big issues about past adoption history is the secrecy and the surprises and the aim of open adoption. And I think we should also be clear. Well, I'll speak for myself rather than and Amy can speak for herself. I don't think we're in the position of being advocates. I think we're in the position of wanting to talk from the research base and that it's an issue of what is the evidence that adoption is in the best interests of children in the longer term and what's the evidence that other forms of care for children. And I think that there's also some evidence, and certainly from the Pathways of Care study in New South Wales, which is the first large-scale prospective study of kids entering care. So we've got a cohort of about 4,000 who had interim orders in 2010-11, and about 2,800 of those went on to have final orders. And of those, about half have been part of an interview study where their carers agreed. And so we're now into the fourth wave. So this is children aged from birth through to 17. And so that's the fourth wave with about 18 to 24 months between them. So those children who were babies, pretty much at birth, who came into the study are now, you know, 7 or 8. And we're starting to see the results. Now, this is a slow sort of thing we're talking about that you need to be able to understand. Those children are being followed wherever they go, as far as they're able to be. So if they return home, if they're adopted, if other options come up. And for the children that aren't in the interview study, there's linked data. So there's health, education, childcare, all sorts of, you know, juvenile justice, their criminal history of their parents, and so on. So there's a way of being able to follow through. And that's the sort of thing that we don't have. Victoria's about to do something a little similar.
Thank you, Professor Cashmore. If you could just put that on notice.
So the key data set. So we obviously.
I was going to ask that.
Perfect. So we have a big gap between what we know, what the research, what the numbers tell us. Obviously, at a federal level, everything's different by state, which sometimes doesn't always work. But what are we missing? What are the key bits of information that we're missing for a nationally consistent framework? We heard evidence from Adopt Change before you were here. We heard some more evidence last week about there just not being a nationally consistent framework. So what would you suggest are the things that we're missing and the things we need to join up so that we don't have another repeat of maybe New South Wales going cart first horse? And
well, to Ms. Hussar's point, if you could take the question, that question on notice, and effectively it's in two parts, which are what are the key data sets that should be collected and how might they be used to better understand the effects of different permanency pathways, and also what are the barriers, in your view, to achieving consistency in data collection at a national framework, if we're going to consistently look at a national framework. So if you could take that on notice, in the interest of time, we'd be grateful.
We can certainly take that on notice. And just to point out that because adoption is a lifelong journey, there is a need to do research to understand, and it takes time. So we're established in 2016, and we are undertaking research. Some of that will take some time, you know, to bear fruition. But there is an investment by the New South Wales government, you know, in terms of understanding the outcomes of children in adoption and other forms of permanency, and to develop the practice in that space. But these things take time to evolve research and service systems.
Well, thank you for your attendance here today. If you have been asked to provide any additional information, would you please forward it to the Secretariat by Monday the 16th of July 2018. You'll be sent a copy of the transcript of your evidence and will have an opportunity to request corrections to transcription errors. I declare this public hearing closed. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks, Professor Cashmore. Thanks, Professor Lowe.